Metro at 5. Some breaking news. Officers in Northern Ireland say they've uncovered what they're describing as a dissident Republican arms dump in Lurgan in County Armagh. They found firearms, pipe bombs and explosives which were in an advanced stage of readiness. Our Ireland correspondent David Blevins explains the significance.
A few weeks ago, the threat level in relation to dissident Republicans who opposed the political settlement here in Northern Ireland was raised, and this is yet another reminder that they remain active and they have the capability.
In separate news, detectives investigating the suspected IRA murders of factory workers in County Armagh 40 years ago have made an arrest. A 59-year-old man's been questioned about the mass shooting in the village of Kingsmill in 1976. Several campaigners from Black Lives Matter have been arrested after blocking roads and disrupting traffic in Nottingham and around Heathrow and Birmingham airports. The protests coincide with the fifth anniversary of the death of Mark Duggan, a black man shot dead by police in London. Black Lives Matter is an American campaign against police aggression, and political commentator Tom Slater thinks it's not appropriate here.
There are particular things that, of course, we need to address, but unfurling a banner saying that this is a crisis and implying that there is some similarity in the US where there is real lingering problems with police brutality, I think is actually borderline insulting.
Dame Lowell Goddard's been asked to appear before MPs to explain why she's resigned as chair of an inquiry into child abuse. She's the third person to quit as head of the investigation into historical allegations. Talks aimed at averting strikes on Southern Railway have broken down without agreement. The train operator says passengers now face misery after the RMT union warned a five-day walkout looks likely to go ahead from Monday. That's the latest. I'm Tim Jones.
BCFM 93.2.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Stockwood, Steve Jones. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, he was sent down for 14 years as a scapegoat for the multi-billion pound LIBOR fraud a year ago last week, known as Rain Man, because he didn't fit in with the coke-snorting city set, preferring KFC to the boozer at lunchtime. Tom Hayes was headhunted from Swiss UBS to Citigroup in London, where LIBOR fixing was organised and sanctioned by the bank executives. But Tom picked up a lot of evidence along the way, even handling a leaflet on how to fix the LIBOR rate he'd been given at UBS by Carsten Kengeter, who's now in the process of taking over the London Stock Exchange. He's not in jail. We speak to Tom's father in an exclusive interview. That's Nick Hayes. Plus, more evidence from the Turkish coup attempt that the US was behind it and the Russians may have saved Erdogan's life. Also, whatever happened to the peace dividend? We get the views of Brave New World author Aldous Huxley on a similar topic. And also, former Iraq and Libya negotiator for the CIA, Susan Lindauer. Plus, Martin Summers' chance, if he cares to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots. That's in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 14 Celsius, a little bit windy, but dry. This weekend, highs of 22, a mainly sunny weekend and breezy at times. Next week, highs of 22, mainly sunny and dry week. Next weekend, the 13th and 14th of August, highs of 21 Celsius, fairly sunny. Doesn't seem like many raindrops around at all. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Conservative Councillor for Stockwood, Steve Jones. Hi, Steve. Welcome to the Politics Show. As a new councillor in May, give us a bit of an introduction to yourself. What's your background?
I have been involved with distributing leaflets and helping my predecessor, David Morris, over the last 15 years, I suppose, as a local resident in Stockwood. David decided to retire this year, and he asked if I would stand in his place, which I was most delighted to be asked, and volunteered graciously, obviously.
Okay, but what about your experience outside politics? What's your background in that way?
My CV, I guess. I left school at 16. I went to Withywood School. I had a brace of O-levels. I didn't get any A-levels, so I didn't stay on for long enough. I then became a painter and decorator for 7 years. I then got into office equipment sales in 1979, and I've been in sales ever since, both as a salesman and a sales manager, and I've worked for some very large blue-chip companies.
Okay, selling what nowadays?
Telecommunications, small business phone systems.
Now, I'm going to be really cruel to you and say, are you the person that's been selling these damn phone systems where you get told press 1, press 2, that kind of thing?
That is a bolt onto a phone system, but yeah, that is a part of something which we have done. That's quite amazing.
Are you still working in your job? Are you retired? Because it must be quite a lot of work doing being a councillor as well as a job.
Well, I am still working, but one of the reasons I decided to stand as a councillor was because my business runs itself in a way. I have people who do the technical stuff for me, so the available time that I have is my own. I can pick and choose my hours.
Okay, why Conservative and not another party?
Is there another party?
Well, there are several other parties you could have chosen. Yeah,
I suppose you could say coming from. Living in a council estate and going to a Withywood school, I'm probably quite unusual in that I am a Conservative, but it's in my blood. I just have Conservative values.
The trouble is, a lot of people point their finger at David Cameron, people like that, and say, well, actually, they're not really Conservative with a small c. They're not keeping things the same, which is what the whole idea of a Conservative could be and should be. Actually, quite a lot is changing, and certainly things like traditional family values are not really Conservative anymore.
I don't know. I can only speak for my own own family values. I've been married since 1982. I have 3 children. I'm still with my wife. And I accept normal, everyday life.
What about some of the things that you've come up against across since you were elected in May? Because I know in some parts of South Bristol anyway, there have been what certainly appear to be these kind of post-Brexit referendum racist attacks. Have you heard any of that in Stockwood?
Absolutely none that has been reported to me in Stockwood. However, I have been aware of other incidents throughout the city in South Bristol. There were some incidents this week, I believe, which I find abhorrent.
And what can we do about this sort of thing? Because, I mean, you're a part of the problem, aren't you? You voted for Brexit.
I absolutely did, yeah. As did the Stockwood ward by, I think it was about 60%. I believe it's a brave new world out there, but I don't think the stuff that we're hearing in the press is acceptable, and I find it is certainly not in my name. That wasn't what I was voting for.
Well, what do you put it down to? Because surely that's part of the whole Brexit thing, is you're kind of inflaming racial tension.
I wouldn't say that was the case. I think it's the option to be independent. Is nothing to do with racial tension. I think it's just opportunistic for some of those that perhaps see it as a permission for them to extol their values onto others that are not necessarily held by the majority.
Almost like an excuse. I mean, don't you think that there may be, for some people, the referendum, the Brexit referendum, has almost been a green light for them to go and express, maybe even violently, some of the feelings that they've kept pent up for years about their actual racist tendencies in people? It's kind of brought it out, hasn't it?
I think it's made there's been an opportunity for those that harbour those sort of feelings and those thoughts to feel that they now have permission to express them in the way that they have. I don't consider them to be acceptable in any way, shape or form.
So why didn't you follow your great leader, David Cameron, and vote to remain?
Why didn't I vote to remain? Because I believe that the country is better off as an independent sovereign nation.
So it's not to you, it wasn't necessarily about migration, immigration. It's more to do with sovereignty. Am I right? You know, because I mean, there's a lot of different ways that this is being spun. Is this a contest between Brussels and Westminster, or is it a contest between imported cheap labour and homegrown labour? So what's your take on the reasons for the vote as it was?
I can only speak for my own thoughts on it, which for me it was to do with self-determination, sovereignty.
Martin, there's been a bit of a spin-off, not a very nice one in South Bristol after the Brexit vote.
Yeah, well, I think it's commendable that Steve is saying that this is unacceptable. I mean, we know these things exist, and you know, referendums tend to be divisive. You know, strong feelings get expressed, but you know, attacking people for who they are is not acceptable to me either. And I was a Remain voter, but let's, you know, we've now got to make sense of what's been decided, and it's not at all clear what exactly is going to happen next.
Well, it certainly isn't. No,
I wonder if I could make an observation, which I think is very important here. A lot of the people that are being abused or on the receiving end of abuse or whatever you might want to call it, or being attacked physically, verbally or otherwise, they've lived in this country possibly as long as I have. I didn't choose to be born in this country. I just happened to be fortunate enough to be born to parents who lived here. I could have just as easily have been born overseas. And the people that live here, whether they've lived here for 10 years or whether they've lived here all their lives, or indeed their parents came over in the 1960s from overseas, they have contributed and they continue to contribute as much to this country as I do. They pay their taxes, they go to work every day, they support their families, and I just think it's completely unacceptable that they should be singled out just because of their ethnicity, for want of a better word.
No, I think totally agree. I think that's pretty much the message from Bristol. Almost everyone in Bristol would agree with you. But apparently in London it's not the same, because this week there was an absolutely shocking case which didn't receive anywhere near as much coverage as I thought it should. Black firefighter allegedly tasered by police said racism is a disease within the Metropolitan Police. He said, "I never imagined in a million years this would happen to me." This is Louise Ridley writing in the Huffington Post. A black firefighter who claims he was violently attacked and shot with a taser by police officers has claimed racism is a disease in the Met. Edric Kennedy McFoy says he no longer trusts the police after officers allegedly behaved like wild animals when he approached them to help solve a potential crime. He claims police officers dragged him from his car in an attack in North London after he approached them as an off-duty fireman to give help identifying a youth who threw a rock at the police van. A group of officers who were responding to calls about an out-of-control party allegedly then surrounded him and tasered him during the incident in September 2011. He was then held in a police cell for 13.5 hours for no reason, he claims. The police complaints watchdog, the IPCC, apologised on Wednesday night after a gross misconduct hearing against three officers in his case collapsed because of procedural shortfalls. Well, Martin, this isn't really good enough, is it? Where the IPCC just basically dropped the ball, they've put a piece of paper in the wrong filing cabinet, and nothing is going to happen now at all to these people who tasered this off-duty black fireman.
Well, I mean, it's hard to comment on individual cases. This sounds pretty bad. And it's a shame that he's not got justice in the end from the Police Complaints Authority.
Well, let's just say one thing we definitely do know about this is his case took 5 years to reach a tribunal. He received an apology and some damages from Scotland Yard, but no admission of any liability for the way he was treated.
I think there is... we were hearing on the main news earlier about Black Lives Matter blocking the M4 today because it's the anniversary of the shooting of Mark Duggan. I think there is still racism in the British police force. It's not as bad as it used to be when I was in my 20s. I used to live in Brixton in that era, and there were some pretty shocking incidents that I saw. The police have improved enormously, but there's still, you know, the standard is always going to be higher and higher. And, you know, I think the comments made earlier that the situation in the US is far worse, that doesn't mean that we can be complacent about the situation here.
Yeah, pretty frightening stuff. I worked for Avon Fire and Rescue for a while, a few years ago, Steve, and one of the things that we were finding was sometimes there were clashes between the fire service and the police service, particularly at accident scenes. Sometimes the police want to totally control the scene, and that is to say they want to basically take over what the fire brigade are doing at a scene, and there is some friction between the two forces. Particularly, one of the things I remember they didn't like, the police didn't like the fire brigade taking any photographs. Actually, this is really useful when it comes to instructing people on how to cut into cars when people are in accidents and that sort of thing. But this kind of control freakery from the police seems as if it's been writ large here in London.
Well, I happened to catch this particular story on the news, I think it was yesterday, and the black firefighter was being interviewed, and I was astounded to think that a police officer could treat him in the way that he was clearly an intelligent, affable, pleasant gentleman. Doing a tough job, obviously, as a firefighter, and how they could have mistaken him for someone who, or treated him as though he was someone who'd done something wrong and therefore ended up tasering him, I find unbelievable.
I mean, this is really, I suppose, Martin, this is really about procedures, isn't it, and about the way the IPCC, just like Mark Duggan, have just simply failed to do their job properly.
Well, I mean, there is a case. The black community are very clear. There's been lots and lots of people, black young people, who've died in police custody, and nobody has been held responsible for any of those incidents, and we're talking about hundreds of incidents now.
Well, just to be fair,
this is
something that's happening right across the board, not just to ethnic minorities.
No, it's true.
I mean, police seem to have, look, this is just me getting on my soapbox here, the police seem to have a get-out-of-jail-free card in their back pockets.
Well, there's always going to be a question about whether the police are protecting themselves and covering their backs and so on. I think the modern police force is very different from the police force that I first came into contact with in my 20s years ago. They were openly racist and openly nasty to people that they thought were the enemy, which didn't just include black people, it included people with long hair.
Like you,
or whatever. You know, that was the attitude of the day. But modern police officers, especially in Bristol, I think, are much more tuned in to the variety of the communities that they deal with. But nevertheless, you're still going to get, don't forget, this is an incident where somebody's thrown a rock at the police, so they're slightly fired up, you know. So, you know, going to be mistakes.
This guy clearly didn't throw the rock. He was there to try and help them identify the person who had, and yet they turned on him, I suppose, just out of frustration, because they couldn't find the person.
It's not very professional,
is
it?
It's totally unprofessional. I also am very worried when the law is not seen to be equal, where police officers seem to be above the law and they feel like they can act with impunity. This is a dangerous world we're going
through. This is what causes such anguish in the community at large, is because lots of young people or older people have died in police custody, and every single one of those incidents has been said, I'm willing to accept that things happen and that not everything is the fault of the police, but every single one, nobody ever held responsible. That defies belief.
Steve, we're also talking this week in London, thank God not here, hundreds of new armed police officers walking the streets. Now, it's one thing with the taser. It's mm-hmm. another thing if a police officer is shooting off some kind of machine pistol into members of the public, for goodness sake.
Well, it's a bit worrying, obviously. I can understand the logic behind it with what's been going on in Europe, with all the problems they've had in France and the like, and Germany. So sending out a message that there's going to be more police officers on the street carrying firearms is almost an inevitability, but it's also sending out the message that, you know, but it didn't work really, did it? Because the following day there was an incident.
Martin, this, I suppose what I'm thinking here is along the lines of some basic, this is really should be like baseline stuff, is you don't let police with guns out onto the street unless you know that if they shoot somebody that they shouldn't shoot, that there will be consequences.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's got to be proper procedures for the use of firearms by the police, hasn't there? It's not, you can't, I mean, this is one of the problems in the US, is because all the police are armed, and so are the criminals that they're dealing with. It's very easy for, you know, I mean, 11,000 people, I think, every year are killed in the United States by guns.
I mean, we do have to guard against any kind of possibility of a police state. Certainly, it seems like that's the way they may be heading in London. But anyway, on to more local stuff, and Cabinet Minister Liam Fox announces this week he's opening three new government offices in the USA. This is in the Bristol Post. Martin, he's the International Trade Secretary, Liam Fox. He was disgraced and discredited in 2011 when he had to resign as Defence Secretary. He was forced to resign because he'd been using this chap, Adam Werety, and taking him around to all many of his official Foreign Office meetings and Ministry of Defence meetings, which it seemed as if a complete breach of security. And now he's opening offices. He's over opening offices for this new department in the USA. George Monbiot wrote a tremendous article in The Guardian. I'm not sure if this was maybe last week, actually. And he's talking about no one embodies this contradiction of taking us out of Europe into the arms of other powers as much as the man now charged with determining the scope of our sovereignty, new International Trade Secretary Liam Fox. He explained his enthusiasm for leaving Europe thus: we'll be able to make our own laws unhindered by anyone else, and our democratic parliament will not be overruled by a European court. But of all the people Theresa May could have appointed to this post, he seems to me the most likely to ensure that our parliament and laws are overruled by foreign bodies. Fox, George Monbiot says, Fox looks to me like a corporate sleeper cell implanted in government. In 2011, he resigned his post as Defence Secretary in disgrace. And he talks about the Atlantic Bridge organisation. He allowed a lobbyist to attend his official meetings without any government clearance. It's extraordinary, he says, that a man with his past has been brought back into government, let alone given such a crucial role.
Well, I think the politics of this, in the leaving aside Fox's bad behaviour in the past and so on, with the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, the Obama administration wants to try and push that through before the election in the US in November. Now, as I understand it, Peter Lilly, who is a conservative but long-standing, he's opposed to the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. But people like Liam Fox, who set up Atlantic Bridge with Werity, they are opposed to the EU. They want to leave the EU, but they're in favour of the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which will be a deal between the United States and the EU, which will overrule completely EU law and British law. There's a contradiction at the heart of all of this, and Liam Fox is that it represents that contradiction. If we're going to be out of the EU properly, we're not going to have a Brexit light like Norway, where we get access to the single market, but you have to have free movement of labour, then we'll have to go under the World Trade Organization rules, and presumably they'll want to sign up to the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, because most right-wingers do, apart from Peter Lilly, which is going to be decided between the Americans and the EU, and we won't even have a say in it, but we'll sign up to it anyway. This is going to come on the agenda very rapidly, and the question of what kind of Brexit we're going to have is already an issue. But Theresa May told him that he wasn't to negotiate with the Americans in any case, because he was negotiating from a basis of we're going to have full Brexit. Whereas in actual fact, Theresa May, I think, and the City of London, what they want is a Norway-style Brexit, whereby we retain access to the single market. Fox doesn't want to do that, but I think there's a big crack at the heart of the cabinet there.
Steve, this is not looking good for Liam Fox, just only a few weeks after Theresa May has appointed him into this brand new, spanking new department, opening offices in the US. It does look as if he's trying to get trade deals going with America, which one might expect an international trade secretary to do. But the problem is, it seems to be anyway, James Ball at BuzzFeed has done a real kind of tight investigation into his charity. It's called Give Us Time. It's some sort of military charity. There's a lot of discrepancies in this charity already. In a nutshell, let's just go through some of the things that BuzzFeed News has found out. Within a month of launching, Liam Fox said the charity had secured 300 weeks or 6 years of free accommodation for families, military families, to have holidays already. But its own accounts show that they'd helped fewer than 130 families in total in the first 3 years. And it gave away less than £110,000 worth of holiday stays over that time. The charity received a grant of £500,000 from the Treasury's LIBOR fund, which has been raised from the fines on the banks. But Give Us Time wasn't listed on the fund's list of successful projects or any government press releases on funding. So, in other words, that's been hidden, that money. Afghan Heroes, the charity that initially ran Give Us Time, was investigated by the Charity Commission in November 2013. To investigate management and administration, and Liam Fox was a patron of that charity. Labour's deputy leader Tom Watson said that Fox must urgently explain Give Us Time's activities and where they got their money from. So it doesn't seem like he's ideal to be running this charity, since there's so many questions being raised about the whole working of it.
Yeah, it's quite a long document that you've allowed me to have.
Yeah, it's an investigation, and I'm not really expecting you to go through it all now, Steve. I just think that if you're running a charity, I mean, we saw this before with this Atlantic Bridge charity that Liam was involved in running, very embarrassing, lots of mistakes and breaches of national security involved in that one. This one here looks like we're heading in a similar kind of direction with all sorts of discrepancies. Why would he need to be doing both his job as an MP and as a now as a senior government minister, but also running these dodgy charities at the same time.
I'd be very surprised. I've met Liam Fox, and I'd be very surprised if he was laying himself open to criticism of doing something that could in any way or shape or form be associated with something that he's been criticised for doing before. So I would treat probably what I've just heard with a degree of scepticism, to say the least.
Well, I mean, for anyone that wants to read this full report, it's a fascinating report by James Ball at BuzzFeed. I'll put a link in on our show page at www.thisweek.org.uk, but it certainly doesn't finish with Liam Fox, because the Labour Party's in a bit of a mess too. Martin, the Labour Party is split here in Bristol East as the members of the party in Bristol East actually go against Kerry McCarthy and say that they're going to be backing Jeremy Corbyn for leader.
Well, I think that's going to be the case this week in Bristol West, which is what I'm a member of. I think the differences between the Labour Parliamentary Party and the sort of grassroots of the Labour Party are fairly clear. In many ways, it's very unfortunate that we're having this kind of leadership election and this kind of contest, as it were. But I think because there is such a difference of opinion, we've got to have some mechanism of resolving it, and having this leadership contest is the way of resolving it. The question, well, what will happen if, as I expect, the right wing of the party don't get what they want? Are they going to knuckle down and cooperate with the rest of us, or are they going to form their own party? I think I think I've always been a supporter of electoral reform, and I think this is one of the problems with first past the post system, is it crams people together in loveless marriages which ought to be separated and more reasonable. I mean, and just on a general fairness point of view, I can't see how UKIP getting 4 million votes and one MP makes any sense. And Theresa May is going to have a problem because she hasn't really got a mandate, because only, you know, the Tories didn't in fact win a 50% majority. They haven't got a 50% majority in the country, and as we go forward, the economy starts to weaken, the rows about Brexit start to occur. The fact that she hasn't actually got a sufficient mandate is going to be a problem for her.
Steve, I suppose you're probably looking on at this and thinking, silly old Labour, I'm glad I'm in the Conservatives. What are they doing fighting each other like this? But on a more serious point, there is a plan apparently for people like Kerry McCarthy to, even if Jeremy Corbyn is re-elected by the Labour membership, to ditch him and maybe to split and start their own party. Do you think that's okay? Because, I mean, the people that got Kerry McCarthy elected, that is the activists in the area, are saying, actually, no, we want you to do this. We want you to do the opposite. So it does seem strange for Kerry to turn against them.
It does, and I was quite surprised when I learned that in the media a few weeks ago, obviously, but she's nailed her colours to the mast, so to speak, and I think the likelihood is, if Jeremy gets reconfirmed, whatever the word is, that there will be a split. I can see it coming, which I don't think will be good for...
Well, if there is a split, YouGov have very conveniently done a little poll for us, and they're effectively saying, Martin, whichever part of the Labour Party splits from whichever other part, that part is not going to do very well, that most of the voters will vote for whoever doesn't initiate the split.
Well, that's fair enough. I mean, the people who initiate the split have to pay the consequences of being the splitters, don't they? We've all seen the life of Brian, you know. They're the splitters. No, you're the splitters. I think the problem is the electoral system. We don't any longer really have a two-party system.
Martin, keep talking about the electoral system. This is nothing to do with that.
It is.
This is to do with, surely, with MPs that aren't doing what the activists who...
No, but what the MPs would argue is that they're closer to the views of the voters than the activists' views. I think that's debatable, actually, but you can see why they're saying that.
What does this all to do with the electoral system?
Because the electoral system forces, in the rest of Europe, for example, in Northern Europe, Norway, Denmark, Germany, you have a moderate centrist left-wing party and a more left-wing party. And the same thing happens on the right. You have a centrist right-wing party, the CDU.
We've got the Greens, and we've got
Yes, sir, but the problem is, with first past the post, all of these things lead to perverse election results, where a minority party, which is what the Tories are, have complete control in Parliament, although they're probably going to split. They've only got a majority of 18. The possibilities for splits are there. The electoral system has already been changed in Scotland, Wales, and of course in Northern Ireland, because it had to be changed if you were going to have any peace in Northern Ireland. Eventually it'll have to be changed in the main part of Britain as well, because we're getting to the point where we no longer have a two-party system.
I've got news for you, Martin. Sorry to keep interrupting you. I've got news for you. No one's going to change it, because only Labour and Conservative are going to be in power, and neither of them are going to change it.
I think that what's going to happen...
We had an alternative vote referendum a few years ago,
and
the public said, no, we're not
interested. Well, indeed, that was very unfortunate that the Liberals agreed to that, because what they should have done is have a minority Tory government, which would have been much more sensible. But the fact is that there is a big gap now between the way the political class operates and the way in which ordinary people perceive politics to be. And we've got a huge... It's not fit for purpose. If they look at us in Germany and Norway and think, you just don't know what you're doing.
Well, the Germans call us the island apes, don't they? So maybe we need to do a little bit of evolving. Anyway, let's have, rather than us gassing on, let's have a listen to the main contenders who were debating for the first time over in Cardiff with each other. That is Jeremy Corbyn and Owen Smith, with a BBC moderator chairing. And I phoned up the BBC in Cardiff midday yesterday and said, where can I hear this on the BBC? Can I hear it, Sid, on the television? Can I hear it on the radio? Oh no, we're not covering any of it. So I don't know quite what they're up to at the BBC. I think, you know, if there are important debates, national debates that are going to affect possibly the future of the entire country, that maybe the BBC should think about actually transmitting them live. Maybe the public might like to hear them. And it was a really lively debate. And let's hear the first extract from that now, which was about why there's a catfight in the first place in the Labour Party. And both of them, Smith and Jeremy Corbyn, with Owen Smith first, setting out their stalls.
172 Labour MPs voted no confidence in your leadership. Now, they're not red Tories. These aren't people who want to see the Tories back in power. They're not Blairites. They're just Labour MPs. No, they're just Labour MPs, Jeremy. And this sort of abuse, this sort of assumption that just because they're not confident in you as our leader, they're anti-Labour, they're red Tories, it cannot be allowed to continue. We can't have this sort of ugly dialogue in the Labour Party. We are fighting like ferrets in a sack. And it's the Tories who will benefit if we aren't united. So, Jeremy, you've got to do more to pull us back together. And I'm afraid I don't think you can.
I'm the last one to do an ugly dialogue with anybody, quite honestly. And I read some memoirs of Harold Wilson at the time I was elected to this position, and he used to, every Wednesday afternoon, open his office and any Labour MP could go and talk to him. I've done the same. I've had very long conversations with a large number of colleagues. I've learnt quite a lot from those conversations. I hope they've learnt things as well. We've got to understand each other better. That surely is the right way of doing things. But we've got to recognise the parliamentary party is very important, a very important part of the Labour Party and the Labour movement, but it's not the entirety of it. We have to represent what our members want, what our affiliates want, and above all, the communities that our members and affiliates represent want as well. Therefore, I was very pleased when we managed to turn it around from abstaining on the welfare reform bill a year ago to absolutely opposing it and eventually working together, defeating them on tax credits.
And who led that campaign, Jeremy? Who led that campaign in your shadow cabinet? I did. I was the shadow secretary of state for DWP, who led the campaign on tax credits and on food. I was the one who took the fight to Ian Duncan Smith. I was the one who mentioned when he fell.
You were the shadow secretary of state.
And I was desperate to fight for a Labour victory. But at the moment, Jeremy, I say again, we're 14 points behind the Tories. We don't look like ousting them from power. And that is because we are not convincing the country that they've got to put back their trust in us so they can look at us under your leadership and see a credible and radical government in waiting.
14 percentage points behind the Tories, Martin. Jeremy's a loser.
Well, in the last local elections in Britain, we had a higher proportion of the vote than the Conservative Party, and we won all four mayoral elections. And in actual fact, why we're 14 points behind is because people like Owen Smith have decided to have this this coup, ineffectual coup. I can't imagine what the Labour MPs in Bristol were thinking, because it was they were never going to be able to remove Corbyn, given the electorate as it is within the Labour Party. We had 180,000 new people joining, all of whom are probably going to vote for Corbyn. They've simply lost the plot, and but we'll have to have this debate, and then they'll have to be beaten, and then we'll have to take it from there.
Okay, one of the big fault lines between Smith and Corbyn is Trident.
I voted against the renewal of Trident.
In fairness to Jeremy Corbyn and also to Owen Smith, if it happens, we are timing this. So if you can keep your applause for Jeremy Corbyn to go through its 40 seconds.
Do I get
can we start?
For that?
Can we start again to make sure that every candidate...
Yes, I voted against the renewal of Trident because I want to live in a nuclear-free world. And I think Parliament was invited to vote for a blank check to the government for renewal of Trident with no financial costing whatsoever behind it. The points I made, and I made them in the leadership campaign last year, were quite simply this. It was a Labour government that developed the nuclear non-proliferation treaty in the 1960s. Article 6 of that treaty requires the declared nuclear weapon states, of which Britain is one, to take steps towards nuclear disarmament. Renewal of Trident is not taking steps towards nuclear disarmament. It's going in the opposite direction. And I want to be in a Labour government that fulfils our obligations and does everything it can to encourage other areas of the world to become nuclear-free zones, which has actually worked and been very effective, okay. And carry out our obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Thank you very much. Thanks. And I appreciate you keeping your applause to the end there, just in fairness to the candidates. Owen Smith, where do you stand on the renewal of Trident?
Look, my great political hero is Aneurin Bevan. And I am a Bevanite on the issue of nuclear weapons. I'm in favour of a world without nuclear weapons. I'm in favour of the Labour Party being in the vanguard of looking for multilateral disarmament. All weapons across the world should be got rid of. Now, if I sincerely believed that I would assist multilateral disarmament, everybody getting rid of their nuclear weapons by divesting ourselves of ours first, then I would do it tomorrow. I used to believe that, but I don't believe it any longer. I believe the world has become a more dangerous, volatile place. I believe Russia is a more dangerous power than it used to be. And my view about this is very clear, that we must retain a nuclear deterrent in order to enable the multilateral disarmament of the entire world's arsenal. That is the unfortunate, terrible truth.
Well, the fact of the matter is that the Liberal Democrats and the SNP, of course, are against renewing Trident, partly on cost grounds. So if there is a split on the right wing of the Labour Party, they're going to have to get into bed with the Liberal Democrats, and the Liberal Democrats have already decided that they don't want Trident. And, of course, the SNP are clear that they don't want Trident. He's not going to get anywhere with that sort of attitude.
What about, I mean, he's pointing out that Russia is a bigger threat than it's been for
the
last 10 years.
That is very, very debatable. Very debatable indeed. All this stuff about how we've got to spend more money on defence because the Russians are threatening us. The Russians are actually crushing ISIS in Syria. And in actual fact, we provoke the conflict in the Ukraine by supporting the sniper attack on the protesters in Maidan Square, which is absolutely clear that wasn't carried out by the Yanukovych regime. It was carried out by the new regime working with our intelligence services. So the problem is that the intelligence services have always tried to dominate the British Labour Party to prevent it from taking anti-American positions.
Well, you're making me think about the Wilson plot.
Well, indeed.
MI5
indeed.
And those wonderful books.
And it's become a shibboleth on the right wing of the party that they've got to be in favour of Trident to keep the Americans happy and to keep the establishment happy.
Which we were talking about.
But the Liberal Democrats have already decided to ditch it.
Len McCluskey was talking about last week. But anyway, look, final clip, and let you comment after this, Steve, is about immigration, which of course is not just an issue in Europe, not just an issue for the Tories. There's quite a split in the Labour Party too about it, and one of the big splits, of course, is whether the Labour Party is going to get behind the referendum result or try and overturn it.
We've seen the Tories play a losing game of setting targets. They played a losing game. Well, I'm not going to turn around and say, let's have a finite target for immigration, because we know it doesn't work. You miss those targets. Many parts of our country require immigration. The nurses in the hospitals. Over the road from us is the Heath Hospital in Cardiff. It's full of foreign nurses.
So we need to agree, but do we need to control a level of it?
Well, I think we need to be honest, which is we do need immigration in this country, and in some areas of the country it causes problems. So our job is to form a government in order to mitigate those problems. It is not our job to inflame pressures
and
inflame divisions in the
country. Control or no control?
I've just said to you, I don't think we should be setting a finite number. But the truth is, we're about to leave the European Union, and that's not going to solve the problems. We should be in Europe fighting for everybody across Europe having a greater degree of control.
The audience can draw their conclusions. Jeremy Corbyn. Should we be controlling
non-European migration is very strictly controlled, often actually very unfairly, particularly where it's a case of family reunion, where arbitrary levels of income are demanded of a family before they can bring children or partner into Britain. I think that needs to be looked at and changed. In the case of European migration, if we're part of a single market with free movement of capital, then what goes with that is free movement of labour. What I've done all through the referendum campaign and before that and since is to demand the signing of the Posting of Workers Directive to prevent the importation of a whole workforce to undercut a workforce that's already here in this country and destroy the wages and conditions in that particular industry. And I've raised this with colleagues all across Europe. The British government finally did concede that it would sign the Posting of Workers Directive. I think bringing about a greater level of economic equality across Europe would actually have a very big impact on that. But Owen's right. We've got to recognise that without migrant workers, we wouldn't have the health service we've got, we wouldn't have the education service we've got, or many other things. And when Farage, in the referendum campaign, produced that utterly disgusting poster, which showed a group of people, desperate people, in that desperate group of people, there were doctors, there were engineers, there were nurses, there were scientists, there were farmers, people fleeing from a war, and he says they are the threat. Surely we can have a hand of humanity rather than a hand of abuse.
Martin, do you think there's any kind of clarity there between the two? Because both of them really seem to be saying it's certainly going to be a long time before there are any real controls on immigration.
Well, I think this is a question for what's going to happen now. I mean, the other European countries have made it clear that if we want access to the single market, you've got to accept one of the four basics of the single market, which is free movement of labour. Now, those who voted for Brexit, many of them presume that that would lead to a situation where you could control other European countries, people coming in or out of Britain. Norway doesn't have that. They're not a part of the European Union, but they're part of the European single market and they have to accept free movement of labour. I think this is going to remain a bone of contention. And I think it's quite interesting that even Ed Balls was saying that perhaps we could negotiate something about free movement of labour with the EU, but he's living in cloud cuckoo land. We've got to go for full Brexit if you want to do that, which means that you won't get access to the single market, which has implications for your economic policy.
Steve, what do you make of the performance of Owen Smith and Jeremy Corbyn there, and also the whole issue? Because it's a big one for the Conservatives too, isn't it? As to what if there is actually ever going to be any kind of exit from the EU? It seems it's being delayed as long as possible.
I thought it was interesting that Owen Smith was agreeing with Jeremy Corbyn about several issues, but he's a bit naive to think that we're going to throw away our nuclear option and hope that others are going to do the same. I thought that was a bit naive, I suppose. There is a lot of danger in the world with Russia and Kim Jong-un and Ariel, is it? Which one is he?
I think it's Andy Kershaw, the DJ, put a great little letter in The Guardian saying, I don't think North Korea is a good enough reason for Trident. I mean, I thought it was quite an apposite way of putting it. But anyhow, on migration, yeah. I mean, it does look as if under Theresa May, this is being kicked into the long grass. They're now saying, oh, after the next general election, that's when we may be implementing Article 50, which is the beginning of the 2-year process to leave the EU. It seems to me as if
Theresa May's government is simply ignoring the referendum.
Well, I think that would be a mistake to do that, quite frankly, because the voice was loud and clear that we wanted out of the EU, and if they wait, 4 years before they start the process, I think there would be a lot of unhappy people.
It's almost like the Hotel California, isn't it? So, you know, you check out, but
you can never
actually
leave.
There is somebody else has decided the way of your country, Martin.
I think that these issues are going to continue to bedevil the Conservative Party. It's a problem. Don't forget, we could have a banking collapse and a major Middle East war,
yeah.
And then both of the candidates were there saying it's very difficult to control international migration. It certainly is. I mean, the United States has massive problems with people coming from Central America and Mexico because the economies there have collapsed because of the North American Free Trade Agreement. So we've had basically heavy-duty restructuring all over the world for the last 30 years, which has destroyed many traditional industries, including farming, for example, in Mexico.
So,
and then we've also provoked major wars, for starting with Iraq.
So the idea that you're going to control immigration after that is pretty fanciful. Maybe the idea is to wait such a long time before we get sovereignty back to Westminster that there's a massive international crisis which will be dealt with by big international companies in Brussels anyway. But it's not just the Labour Party. We're talking about that, and we're hearing the appalling, really, I have to say again, that the BBC Cardiff decided not to transmit that. Brilliant. It was really interesting to get all the reaction from the audience too. But UKIP is also in a bit of a mess at the moment because they have had, obviously after the resignation of the leader Nigel Farage, a leadership election of their own. But Stephen Wolfe, Douglas Carswell and Suzanne Evans were the three main front runners to take over from Farage. None of them is being allowed to stand.
Scandalous. I can't believe it.
So we've got a stitch up in the Conservative Party with no proper election for the leader, where Angela Leadham stood down. There was no opportunity for Conservative members to vote for who they wanted to take over from Cameron. Only the Parliamentary Party. We've got this crisis going on in the Labour Party and in UKIP too. It seems like our politics has been deliberately messed about with.
No, it's a very exciting time to be getting involved in politics. Obviously, I'm new to my role, but The world has gone into meltdown here over recent weeks, hasn't it?
It's good for radio.
The top donor, Aaron Banks, is suggesting that because of all this messing about with who's allowed to stand as UKIP leader, he might just start another party.
I think he might need to anyway, because the raison d'etre of UKIP was to get us out of Europe, and they were successful in doing that, weren't they?
We'll see after 2010. Yeah. I mean, there's still definitely a role for UKIP out there in trying to hold our politicians to account to actually do what the referendum asked them to do. But Martin, what do you make of this catfight going on in UKIP with the main leaders, not being allowed to stand?
As I said before, I mean, UKIP got 4 million votes at the last election and one MP. Sinn Féin got 4 MPs elected, although they don't take their seats by tradition. So this is not really a functional political system. It's become a bit of a mess.
That's not really quite what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the leadership of these three parties, Labour, Conservative and UKIP, all seems to be a stitch-up. There doesn't seem to be any real influence of the ordinary party members in who is leading those parties.
There is. I mean, the Labour Party membership are about to defy the parliamentary leadership, as you will see. I think the problem is that Brexit has created all of these, you know, it's a time of turmoil. You know, people are, you know, can anybody remember George Osborne? Do you remember him? He's dead now. And we're not going to bring the deficit down by 2020. That's all over. That's just, we've missed all of this in what we've been talking about. The whole economic policy of the government has been shot out of the water, but nobody's talking about it.
On the economy, lots going on as well. Home ownership in England is at the lowest level in 30 years as the housing crisis grows. We heard this week. This is Hilary Osborne. I think that's Guardian or The Independent. I'm not quite sure what Hilary's writing in. But really, this is a bit of a disaster for the Conservatives. Surely, Steve, you know that the whole point, or one of the whole points of the housing policy, is we want to expand home ownership. Well, it's at the lowest level for 30 years now.
Yeah, according to the figures you showed me earlier, they are. I think it's a worrying thing that the percentage of new starter homes is very low, but that's caused by having to have 40% new properties on a development, which causes problems with developing land with large housing developments. Then the value of properties is so high that you need a humongous great big deposit to be able to get onto the housing ladder. I suppose, liken it to when I was starting out, my deposit on my first house was 5%, which was £23,000 house, £1,150 deposit. Well, that house now is worth £250,000, so if I had 5%, that's £12,500 I'd have to find. So it's not disproportionate, but people these days are being asked to put 30 grand down, which, you know, parents are having to help with, which is a bit worrying because I don't have 30,000 to help my children.
So where's it all gone wrong? The conservative idea of home ownership, where's it all gone wrong?
I just think it's the housing market is overheating itself all the time, and people invest in bricks and mortar, and then you've got buy-to-let home ownership, which is forcing the first-time buyers out of the market because the buy-to-let people are prepared to pay a little bit more for a property than someone would normally pay.
It's interesting, isn't it, Martin? It looks like the rich are spending more and more, putting more and more of their money into housing and excluding the poor or even, you know, sort of people with a fair amount of money. One example, just from this report, the Labour Force survey, shows in early 2016 only 58% of households in Greater Manchester were homeowners, compared with 72% in 2003. So, I mean, it's just that people with money are coming in and buying houses. Houses are there for us to live in, not just as an investment.
Well, if you think that it was the government which built the most council housing in Britain was the Macmillan government in the 1950s. It was a Tory government. And there was an understanding that the state had a responsibility to provide decent, low-cost housing for people who couldn't afford to get on the housing ladder. And that also, of course, meant that there was a choice about whether you got onto the housing ladder or not. It kept the prices of private property, private houses down. And there was a balanced policy until the Conservatives overturned that in the 1980s, which was very politically successful, giving people loads of free money, because that's what it was, effectively.
Well,
selling the houses.
Aren't they doing the same now with housing associations?
They're doing the same thing with housing associations, although the SNP have just put a stop to it in Scotland. This whole emphasis on home ownership has basically distorted the British economy for years. It's what they used to call stop-go, which is actually go-stop. So you get a housing bubble developing in the southeast of England. You have to raise interest rates to bring that down, and that crushes industry north of the Wash, which is what the United Kingdom used to be about, balancing these forces, but it's not anymore.
You're talking about interest rates. It's come down, hasn't it, for the first time for 10 years or so,
to
a quarter of 1% this week. I mean, you know, it does seem like it's deck chairs on the Titanic time. But fears of a new financial crisis after reporting to the Bank of England stress tests. This was in Metro, in the Metro paper on Wednesday. New report dubbed the Bank of England economic stress test worse than useless, sparking fears of a new financial crisis. Well, actually, there's a whistleblower as well, isn't there, who came out earlier this week. In fact, he's just come out of jail, I believe, earlier this week. I'm just trying to find that story. Rogue UBS trader Kwaku Adeboli says banks are still at risk of huge frauds. In interviews with the BBC, he said traders at investment banks were still under great pressure to generate big returns in an industry that's less profitable than it once was, creating incentives to break the rules. So it seems like there's no real regulation of the banks still, and the same kind of thing that happened in 2008 could happen again. No one's really done anything about it. The idea of having a stress test, it's interesting to hear, Martin, that they're useless.
It's the Adam Smith Institute who was saying this. I don't generally agree with them, but then I think they're right in this particular case. The problem, we've not really been talking about the financial crisis while we've been talking about Brexit. And in actual fact, if Deutsche Bank collapses, as I suspect it may do this summer or into the autumn, that will pull down the banking system, the global banking system.
If it does, will it be Brexit's fault, or will it have happened anyway?
Brexit, it's like the subprime mortgages in the US, which tipped everything over. That it wasn't the subprime mortgages were simply the touch paper that lit the bomb. The real bomb is the derivatives market, as Warren Buffett says. You know, these are weapons of financial mass destruction. And the problem is that any collapse anywhere, Brexit has increased international tension and fragility, so it had a big effect on the Japanese stock market and so on. And it's not because of Brexit as such, it's because the system is actually on the edge of collapse anyway, and nobody's been talking about it. That's what we should have been talking about for 7 years, but we haven't.
Okay, another apart from biggie, just announced late last night and this morning. How's the troubled inquiry into child abuse? How did it all start collapsing? Because it's Dame Lowell... was written to the Home Secretary last night saying that she doesn't want to be part of the VIP defile inquiry. It was set up by Theresa May in July the 7th, 2014. We've had Baroness Butler Sloss, who had family connections, was Attorney General during the 1980s when a lot of these abuse allegations were kicked into touch. Then we had Dame Fiona Wolf, who had a very close family link to Leon Britton. She was forced out. And now this child sexual abuse VIP defile chairman has been forced to resign again. It's a fiasco, but one does wonder whether this is an establishment fix-up, basically, so that that somehow the establishment has, you know, it's a bit like, it reminds me a bit of the Princess Diana inquest, where we had loads of coroners, they'd start their inquiry, then they were removed, resigned, whatever, and it takes years and years for it even to get going, Steve.
Yeah, conspiracy theorists abound, really, don't they? But I find this very worrying myself, because it's a subject that I find quite upsetting. And if this lady has decided to resign after, 18 months, I suppose, that begs a question, what has she learned, or what pressure has been brought to bear upon her to make that decision?
Martin?
Yeah, well, I have to second that. Obviously, we don't know the full detail here. The suspicion is, when the Kinkora Boys Home has been included in this investigation, Kinkora was being used by MI5 as a place to blackmail loyalist paramilitary leaders who were having sex with boys underage, and they were being protected because it was run by the security services. That's what I think's been going on, and not just in Britain, is that child sex abuse is used as a blackmail tool by the intelligence services.
Harvey Proctor and Lord Janna's family saying, we refuse to cooperate with the inquiry. Well, what's the point of an inquiry if people can just say, oh, we're not going to cooperate?
Well, I think underlying all of this is the use of child sex abuse as a blackmail tool. That's what's the real issue. That
interesting, they're trying to keep that covered up. Okay, final story, Leytonstone tube stabbing. The ISIS fanatic, this is in big inverted commas, Mudin Maya, was sentenced to life after a knife rampage at the underground station. This took place earlier this year. It's actually December the 5th last year at Leytonstone. But Martin, they're doing two things here. First of all, they're saying he's crazy, and they're secondly saying, oh no, he's an ISIS terrorist. Can he be both at the same time?
Well, listen, there isn't really time to go into all the detail of where ISIS came from and who funded and supported them, except to point out that their major support is in Saudi Arabia and Turkey, and Turkey's part of NATO.
Also this week, a London stabbing suspect was a Norwegian Somali. This is in Russell Square just this week, earlier this week, and a similar kind of thing. It seems to me, Steve, that whenever you've got particularly an Islamic or black minority ethnic person out there who's crazy, who hasn't been treated, that they are now can be identified as a terrorist.
Yeah, that's a bit worrying. I read some of these sort of, or listen and watch these things develop on the news, thinking to myself, is this a way of covering up the fact that it was an ISIS terror attack by suggesting that the person was unhinged, but mentally unstable. But okay.
Sorry, I'm going to have to cut you off there because it's time for the Murdoch News at 6. Thanks very much to our guest. That was Conservative Councillor for Stockwood, Steve Jones. After the news, BCFM, Kevin Carhill and Rain Man, who was locked up for 14 years. I think he's had a little bit of a break in his sentence, but we talked to his father all about the LIBOR scandal and who should really have gone to jail instead of Tom.
Live from the Sky News Centre.